This podcast is about correcting the balance, whether it's something celebrated as good when it shouldn't be, or the other way around. Or maybe the heroic tales of history just need to be knocked straight on their ass. Me? I just want to share the complete picture, because that's when this whole thing gets fun. Warning, jokes and sarcasm may ensue. Welcome to Prick the Balloon. Hi, I'm Mike Vance, and welcome to episode 14 of Prick the Balloon. Today, friends, humans, reprobates, I am here to help rescue a really good word. Language changes, you know, and perfectly good words get co-opted or change meanings. Sometimes it just happens. It's evolution, like monkey tails and those other six dog nipples. I mean, today, if you try to compliment someone by calling them swell or peaches or boss or even groovy and far out, people just blankly stare at you and feed you Jell-O salad, the kind with shredded carrots for no good reason. The word dinner is from the French déjeuner, meaning breakfast. Then for centuries it meant the American midday meal. And finally, rich snobby bastards who knew how to use forks ruined it for the rest of us and started eating later in the day. And thus the word lunch was born. Total migration. But hey, no harm, no foul. The word gay was applied to the entire decade of the 1890s to mean happy. And nobody was even thinking about Peter Allen or chest waxing. Other words get pushed into nether regions for more nefarious purposes. Heritage was a completely fine word for centuries, used on museums and everything. Then it got kidnapped by a right-wing think tank, which is perhaps the ultimate oxymoron. And after that, not just kidnapped, but seriously roughed up and prison-raped by every knuckle-dragger who wanted to claim he didn't mean anything by waving the Confederate stars and bars around. It's not hate, it's our heritage. Oppressing and belittling minorities is just our heritage. We don't mean nothing by it. When we put up signs telling dark-skinned folks that we'll kill them if they're not out of town by sundown, that's just how we are. It's our heritage. When we cut eye holes in our mama's bed sheets and go lynch people and burn down their houses and try to massacre entire neighborhoods, we ain't judging nobody. Heritage, not hate. And there goes a perfectly good word flushed down the toilet for the foreseeable future like a carnival goldfish. But the word I have in mind today is populist. P-O-P-U, list. Somehow, a bunch of lazy-ass journalists who can't be bothered to go beyond an iPhone app to seek a bit of history and vocabulary have applied the word populist to people like the Orange Goon and Nazi followers in places like Hungary and Poland and Belarus, if Belarus had things like elections. Those Eurojournos, as we call them here in the, well, someplace, I'm sure, have gone so far as to just equate the word populism with the word fascism. Here's the thing, though. There was already a word for fascism. It was fascism. Use the word. Know the word. Cottage cheese is not ricotta. Calling a billiard table a fucking duck will not make it quack. Shit, that meltdown came earlier than normal. Anyway. Populist, at least here in the good old U.S. of A., are the literal root of modern liberalism, and we're fixin' to explore the history of that. I use the word fixin' for a very good reason, by the way, because populism in its purest form, thus the primary root of many of the types of policies we associate with liberalism today, originated largely in the state of Texas. Yes, Texas. Feel free to hit pause and grab some smelling salts. I'll wait right here with my deer jerky and a bottle of Pearl Light. Okay, you're back. Before we get to the populist, let's spend a minute going over a couple of basics about Texas history. First off, unlike the East Coast liberals who assume all American history came from England, neatly wrapped in a tweed jacket that smelled faintly of pipe tobacco and boiled eels, about two-thirds of the continental U.S.'s territory was either French or Spanish. Texas had a little helping of both, but mostly Spanish. It was the ideas of the Enlightenment that were behind the 11-year-long revolution that created Mexico with Texas and Arizona and California and New Mexico as part of it. Then, in 1834, when the president of Mexico, who had gotten elected as a liberal or federalist, suddenly decided to switch and become a centralist or conservative, siding with the church, the rich people, and the army, most of Texas, both the Tejanos who had been around for over a century, and the Anglo-Americans, some of whom had been around for like a week, sided with the Federalists. Now, I am not suggesting any sort of through line, but it's just some background to say that this concept of Texas as always being some kind of bedrock conservative bastion is a fresh, steaming, fungi-infused cow patty of untruth. And we'll spend the next half hour or more proving that, indisputably, no matter how much some little radical righty snowflakes try to prevent people from knowing real history. Ah. For starters, I'll mention that a goodly number of the earliest Anglos who came from the United States, the people who modern white folks often think of as the founding Texans, came from the Northeast. Even Stephen F. Austin himself had gone to boarding school in Connecticut. Most of them, of course, chose to come to Texas in hopes of making either more money than they had been or hurriedly fleeing indictment. But some just also happened to tote a satchel of forward thinking along for the boat ride. One worth mentioning was a guy named Elijah Pease, with a Connecticut and Massachusetts background, who got to Texas in time to make the convention that declared independence from Mexico. For the third time, mind you, but it was the one that got all the views on TikTok. Pease wrote the state's first criminal code of law, then got elected governor, and founded the first public mental hospital, schools for the deaf and blind, made the first attempt at establishing a system of public schools, though he kind of forgot to provide an adequate system to pay for them. So I guess he deserves credit for setting that modern precedent, too. Yay us! The thing about 19th century Texas is that it had diversity like no other place in America. Until the 1850s, over half the state was still controlled by the Comanches. You had this significant stew of Hispanic, which in this case meant entirely Mexican descent, plus people of African descent, plus Anglos, plus some French settlements, and there was way more mingling between those groups than you think there was, by the way. Then, in the late 1840s, you got an infusion of German free thinkers. Normally, immigrants go to a new country because they're broke and exploited in the old one. Some flee violence, but mostly it's just a search for better opportunity. But this 1848 bunch from all those little duchies and principalities, kingdoms and imperial margarines of Northern Europe were intellectuals like professors, engineers, doctors, and lawyers who had pushed these revolutions against the conservative monarchies. Thing was, though, they lost. So, in 1848 and 49, they're looking for new homes, and boatloads of them end up in Central and West Texas. When I say intellectuals, these people speak Latin to each other because they're kind of douchey little show-offs, sort of like if Sheldon Cooper was on a beer and sausage diet. They are also atheists. They're mostly anti-slavery and anti-military. They think the government should be something formed for public good. Imagine that. When the Confederacy takes power in Texas, these German 48ers are overwhelmingly against it. Some of them end up ass deep in alligators against it. But that's all stuff for another topic. Now, suffice to say, their ideas were added to this Texas stew. By the end of Reconstruction, the South was having a crisis of capital. Nobody had any money, and that turned into a mechanism for the bankers and merchants to consolidate wealth. It was partially tied to the national debate starting in the 1870s over the gold standard, and this is one of those topics that will make even the most aware human's eyes roll back in their head until they pass out in a heap as if they were just forced to watch a tennis match. Meanwhile, economists, who have regularly been spotted in Area 51, start prattling on about some highly volatile, nominally denominated Keynesian prime variables with the tossing and turning and the, oh, mommy, time to change the sheets. By and large, today, those of us who aren't effete snobs with ironic fedoras go through life knowing the dollar in our pocket can be exchanged for something that is priced at a dollar. But at the end of Reconstruction, the Eastern bankers and textile traders wanted to base the value of a dollar on the price of gold because they were interested in more trade with foreign countries. It was the age-old rich getting richer scenario, while railroad men, manufacturers, miners, and especially farmers were taking major hits because the commodities they dealt with, like corn and cotton, fluctuated for entirely different reasons than the price of gold. No one was clamoring for soybean-based currency, though, were they? No. To top it all off, Congress, dominated by those Eastern conservatives, tried to take silver coinage, like the basic silver dollar, completely out of circulation. The short and curlies of the matter was that all of this policy made East Coast bankers and fat cats all the fatter, while American farmers were getting it like they were dropped off at a sister's cotillion in Shawshank prison. And we're not talking about big-ass corporate farmers of today driving Lamborghini tractors with a built-in foot spa. These were small farmers. And as the Texas frontier moved west and north after the Civil War, and as Americans killed off the Comanches, the number of farms were growing by the tens of thousands. These little farmers couldn't get cash. They couldn't get affordable credit. They couldn't get decent rates to transport their crops to market or even store their crops. And consequently, more and more of them were losing their own land and being pushed into sharecropping to make the old plantation owners rich again. All of that is backdrop and context for the founding of the Farmers Alliance, which started in Lampasas County, Texas, in 1877. The first few ideas, like prearranged trade agreements and co-op cotton gins and oil mills and flour mills, helped some farmers, but didn't do squat for those who didn't have any cash on hand to participate. There'd been a somewhat similar farmers group that started in upstate New York in 1868 called the Grange, but it was really more of a social lobbying kind of group. They were nonpartisan, and their biggest goal was to get government regulation to make the railroads lower their shipping rates. They also pushed for rural free mail delivery, which later got Ken Berry his own TV show. The Grange's biggest victory was a court case called Munn v. Illinois, and that was about grain warehouses, where the Supreme Court said that the government could regulate private businesses that served the public interest, meaning a large number of farmers that had to store grain there. But that got overturned 10 years later when the court made a hard right-wing turn, if that sounds familiar. Probably they made the turn on red without signaling. After a decade or more, the Grange took a downhill turn anyway. But this Farmers Alliance in Texas went way beyond the Grange in what they wanted to do. Once the farmers figured out that half-assing it wasn't working, they jumped in whole hog, to use a rural phrase about hogs, which are generally found on farms in rural areas. These guys wanted some serious change. Some of them were those immigrant Germans, and others were good old American Anglo-Saxons or Scots or even, God forbid, Irish. More on that ethnic makeup in a moment, though. The Farmers Alliance wanted greenbacks. That system relied on paper money issued and backed by the United States government that cut inflexible gold prices and corrupt private bankers out of the system. One thing the Alliance came to realize was that old saw about strength in numbers really, really worked. Unless you were trying to separate the drunk redhead from the rest of the bachelorette party. The alliance started thinking in terms of cooperative arrangements and combining the local alliances into a big state alliance. The Farmers Alliance then went national with Charles McCune, a Texan, who thought this great idea needs to be spread across the West and South. McCune became the national leader, and he was this total catch-me-if-you-can kind of guy. The kind of person who makes you want to give the 19th century a try. I mean, if it wasn't for the lack of indoor toilets and deodorant and antibiotics and Cheez-Its. Never underestimate the power of savory snacks in affecting time travel, by the way. Anyway, McCune worked in a pharmacy. Then he got a job as a cattle drover. Next, he was a house painter, and then a newspaper editor. Then he painted houses again while he studied medicine and became a doctor. With that money, he bought several farms and got a passion for agriculture. He became the national president of the alliance. He established and edited a few more newspapers just for shits and giggles. He became a lawyer, and he ended up life being a Methodist preacher. And Tom Hanks never did catch him, but he did get to meet Christopher Walken for drinks. Some of the alliance ideas didn't pan out. There was a joint mortgage idea, like getting co-signers who were better off farmers to sign for farmers in debt. The banks refused to go along with that, although they were doing similar things for other types of clients. The alliance went into cooperative purchasing, trying to buy supplies and equipment that farmers needed directly from the manufacturers and cut out the middlemen who had been gouging them on what were already razor-thin margins that fluctuated entirely at the whim of crop prices. In other words, too little rain or too much rain, and your family may not be eating regularly that year. But maybe the biggest great idea was the idea of cooperative credit. The way things had worked in the past, a farmer had to go hat in hand to Mr. Potter, the local banker, saying, "Please, sir," like Oliver, only without the catchy music. I mean, a dance and chorus of little urchins may have really helped, but these poor slobs were on their own. When it came time to buy seed for the New Year's crop, they had to go borrow money. The plow your mule hauled around busted on some of that rocky soil out in West Texas? Borrow more money. Lord forbid that your mule stays out all night and catches the clap from that hussy over at the Thompson place. Then you need money for a new mule. Another common thing was to get credit directly from the store. The local merchants give you 200 burlap sacks or 100 pounds of fertilizer, some feed grain or that new hoe, and I don't mean that Jezebel of a Molly mule. When the harvest comes in, the first cut of the income goes to pay off the bank loans, plus whatever high interest they were charging, and the store bills, and whatever high interest they were charging. And if you think your credit card rates are bad, these merchant crooks were charging interest rates from 20 up to 200%. That's a number that would make Paulie and Big Pussy throw up their hands and tell you to Vaffanopoly. On top of all that, if the weather screwed you that year, or any number of other factors brought the price of cotton down, then your debt got rolled over to the next year, if you were really lucky. But more likely, the bank took your damn farm, and you were forced to become a sharecropper with the thick-soled boot of the man on your back for the rest of your shortened span of remaining days. I love to paint a rosy picture. With the Farmers Alliance Cooperative Credit Plans, any farmer, cash or not, could deposit his crops in a warehouse, and the alliance negotiated a market price as a big supplier, now selling directly to the textile manufacturers. The interest rate was 1% a month from the time your bales are shipped to the warehouse to the time you come pick up your portion of the sale money. But there were constant battles. At one point, they had to boycott jute bagging, the stuff you wrap around cotton bales, because the eight companies who made it were price fixing. The man always wants a bigger cut. Ow. Not surprisingly, a few years in, the people in the Farmers Alliance realized that having their own political power would be a big help, like not having to yell for the neighbor when you find yourself stuck on the roof. The Democrats had been supporting some of the alliance ideas, but not all, and by 1891, there came a split in Texas. So pretty much that same group of people who were hardcore alliance folks formed a new political party. They were populists. That wonderful American word that Eurotrash tabloid writers just need to back the fuck away from. Put down the keyboard cloths. Things don't have to get ugly. In Texas, the good common man folks formed the People's Party. They took all of those Farmers Alliance ideas, plus some of organized labor's ideas. Go back and listen to that episode, by the way, on the Knights of Labor who say nee, and put them into their platforms. People's Party populists were vehemently against monopolies and corruption in all of its forms. They wanted to see railroads and telephones and telegraph lines become publicly owned utilities, because no one should be making profits on such vital things that everyone had to use. They wanted secret ballots for voting, and no, that was not at all the case before then, which led to beatings and murders and forced feedings of Jell-O pudding. Butterscotch. Yuck. They wanted a shorter work week than the 6 12-hour days that were the norm at the time. They sought to modernize government agencies, expand government services, lower costs, and increase efficiency. They pushed for direct election of senators, since up to that time, the state legislatures got to decide which corrupt fat cat got to go to the U.S. Senate. Imagine that sleazy setup, no matter what state you live in. They wanted consumer protection laws, a graduated income tax, and agricultural subsidies. They wanted everyone to have a fair shake on a playing field that was not heavily tilted in favor of bankers and big business. In other words, they were damn tired of trying to bowl uphill. The populists also carried some of the alliance ideas like cooperative warehouses to the next level and asked for government warehouses that would operate as sort of a crop loan, and then they added in land loans. Now, this is American history, and there is not a single issue that wasn't affected by race, so how did the populists fare in that regard? As a party, the record of the Texas People's Party on race was one of the better ones you'll find between the 1880s and 1860s. Still, their conservative opponents regularly used Jim Crow as a wedge to separate and break them up, and it worked. Many of those ex-Confederates were not ready for a totally integrated society. But to be totally fair, neither were most of the ex-Yankees in the North, and neither were most of the Republicans in Congress last Tuesday. The Texas People's Party appointed blacks to some leadership roles. There were some Tejanos included, even though that population was still mostly confined to South Texas. Some of the folks understood that the poor farmers came in a variety of skin tones, and that banding together for the common good meant exactly that, with everybody included. On the other hand, some of the populace in Texas and all over the country were not buying into this racial inclusion thing at all. Texas tended to have more of the open-minded than many of the other populist state organizations, but that didn't mean all of them. One of them in South Texas wanted to deny Mexican Americans the vote, though it's tough to say how much of that really came down to pure racism and how much was politics aimed at the South Texas Democratic political bosses who were getting their big rancher cronies to wrangle all the Tejanos who worked for them into one big voting bloc supporting the conservative Democrats. Nonetheless, the dude pushing that claptrap got slapped down by the state populist party. The Populist Party candidate for Texas governor in both 1892 and 1894 was a guy named Thomas Nugent. He came to populism from the angle of devout religion. He was a Swedenborgian, which was this movement that thought Jesus wasn't coming back to Earth until humans cleaned up their act and dressed like Lena Olin. The top of the sin hit list for them was greed and avarice, sitting just barely above reruns of Mad About You. Nugent very genuinely wanted human betterment. For him, giving a fair chance to poor farmers and laborers was a high moral crusade. But maybe he didn't literally mean all humans. Nugent tried to play the race issue both ways. He actively campaigned for the black vote at the same time that he was saying that everyone needed to give up this crazy idea of, quote, impossible social equality, end quote. Again, by and large, the Southern populace were either ex-Confederate soldiers or sons of ex-Confederate soldiers. And the ones in Texas, at least, more often than not, were operating just fine as a multiracial organization. That is, until Charles McCune expanded the organization into other Southern states, at which point blacks were barred from membership. The one Texas populist who really stands out for his dripping carnival of blood racist hatred was a guy named Jim Cyclone Davis. He was one of the very few lawyers who were involved with the Farmers Alliance and the People's Party, but what he could do was talk and rabble-rouse. He was in his mid-30s at the time, but he toured the country as far east as Pennsylvania and Maryland with this spellbinding, rabble-rousing evangelist preacher style, rallying people to the merits of populism. He was 6'3", wore a long coat, and had this electrifying John Carradine biblical demeanor when he talked, sometimes talking for hours. He would quote Thomas Jefferson and rail against Democrats and Republicans alike as being Hamiltonian, meaning conservative money bags out only for themselves. Davis would cry, quote, "The crowd that take their politics from Alexander Hamilton is the crowd we have to beat," end quote. And remember that shit next time you go to the musical. That was my add-in, not his. Anyway, Cyclone Davis lost a few close elections, including one for Congress in 1894, and that made him one of the first populists to seek fusion with the Democrats and try to move that party to the left, which is something they were ultimately successful in doing nationwide. Davis himself finally got elected to Congress from Texas in 1914 and was pro-farmer and pro-labor. He opposed World War I and even tried to include a bill that said, all right, if you're going to draft the little man, let's also draft some of the millionaire's money to pay for this whole debacle. So far, so good, right? Except that Cyclone Jim Davis also started promoting the Klan about that time. Mind you, the populists are dead and buried by the 1910s. But come to think of it, when Cyclone lost that close election back in 1894, he did mumble a bunch of stuff about Jews and Catholics. So he's not spreading this horseshit as a populist, but it's the same guy. It turns out old Cyclone maybe should have been called Cyclops, as in Grand Wizard, all along. He spent his last years haranguing people in Dallas about the dangers of Wall Street and all the rosy promise of white supremacy. Possibly he was also wetting himself and pushing dirty overcoats around in a hijacked shopping basket. Hard to tell. It's like he started out as this annoying jerk of a reality show host and suddenly turns into a full-blown malignant scourge of equality. Okay, bad example, since the reality show Freakazoid never did anything remotely good in the first damn place. To combat the racist side of things, there was a Colored Farmers Alliance that formed in Texas after the larger Southern Farmers Alliance kicked out the black members. Like most aspects of life during Jim Crow, the African Americans developed a parallel pathway. They claimed 1.2 million members in the United States by 1890. They established exchange co-op warehouses in Houston, Charleston, Mobile, New Orleans, and Norfolk. They raised money to extend school terms by paying teachers. They promoted black home ownership. Occasionally, they worked together with their white counterparts. But when it came to a voting rights bill, the Deep South Farmers Alliance opposed them. For that brief moment in time, a goodly portion of them also voted for the People's Party. In the early 1890s, the People's Party, or populists, were a viable national third party. How well did they do exactly, though? As far as presidential elections, 1892 was pretty much it. The 1892 People's Party ticket was all about unity. The presidential candidate was James B. Weaver, a former Union general from Iowa who had run on a third-party ticket before. They paired the Union general with a former Confederate officer from Virginia. The populist won 5 states and got those electoral votes: Nevada, Kansas, Colorado, Idaho, and North Dakota. They topped a third of the votes in Alabama, South Dakota, and Oregon, and got just short of half the votes in Wyoming and Nebraska. In Texas, the populists got right at 25%, but elsewhere, they fell flatter than Callista Flockhart on a pool table. Down the ballot, the populists in 1892 elected 5 U.S. senators, 10 U.S. House members, 3 governors, and 1,500 state and local officials. I mean, shit, that's enough to be a ruling coalition in Italy, until the government collapses again next month. By 1896, many of the People's Party true believers wanted to merge back with the Democrats, and that's what they did. William Jennings Bryan, who will be the subject of a future podcast, was the Democratic nominee, but his running mate for vice president was Tom Watson, not the golfer, but a full-fledged member of the People's Party from Georgia. It was like a fusion ticket, like Boudin egg rolls, but not nearly as delicious. And that's because Tom Watson was a bitter son of a bitch. After the ticket got their asses handed to him in the election, Watson went off blaming Catholics, Jews, and blacks. Not at all like that relatively open-minded bunch of Farmers Alliance folks that had started this whole thing in Texas 15 years earlier. 1896, and the dream was over. By the end of the 1890s, only a few Texas counties still had a viable People's Party presence. And then it was only because they had banded together with the remaining black Republican voters, those freedmen and their sons, to fight against a corrupt Democratic political boss. The same thing happened in a couple of places in North Carolina. One of those places in Texas was Orange County, right in the far southeast corner, nestled up to Louisiana and totally overrun with feral crawfish and drunk nutria rats wearing Mardi Gras beads. I wrote about a bloody years-long feud that went on there, well into the first decade of the 1900s. It involved Texas Rangers getting shot in barber shops and killing local lawmen on the street corner, and shameless plug, it's all in my book, Getting Away with Bloody Murder. The murder part, though, doesn't apply here, but it all started, that whole feud, over the reassertion of Jim Crow and a few hardcore People's Party holdouts. What makes the Texas populace so important is that the ideas they spread around the South and West got absorbed by the progressive Democrats, those exceptions I just mentioned notwithstanding. Their national foe was Wall Street and the Republicans, but on a state level in the South, it was the conservative Democrats because there were no more Republicans. Mostly, the People's Party got absorbed into the Democratic Party with some grumbling, like the back talk from your dog when you tell him to quit barking. It was a severe loss to the cause, but not a total loss when you look at it over the longer arc of history. And yes, that is one of those poetic academic phrases that make me hang my head in shame. I am very sorry. Please. At first, the party merger may have been out of political self-preservation for both sides, but enough of the populace turned Democrats truly believed in those radical left-wing and socialist notions to make them into law over coming decades, and a lot of them have become absolute bedrock that no one would dare question today unless they were sitting in Montgomery Burns' drawing room, sipping endangered grape cognac, tightening their gorilla vest, and throwing another peasant on the fire. It's interesting when you look back at some of the progressives personally, like Woody Wilson and Teddy Roosevelt and Bob La Follette from Wisconsin, they personally opposed the populist in elections and seemingly had no love for them, though they shared a great number of ideas. For decades, Texas continued to have these solid progressives, plus some half-ass progressives, though they all remained divorced from notions of racial equality. The progressives kept a bunch of those populist ideas, but none of them were as brave as the best of the populist had been back in the 1870s and 1880s, standing up for integration. Things were moving backwards in regards to race. By 1912, that famous three-way election between Wilson, Roosevelt, and "Hey, pizza boy, come inside so I can give you a tip." Boom, chicky, boom, boom. Texas politics were a total Democratic Party show. In that election, 1912, in the state of Texas, old racist Woody got 73% of the vote. Taft, the Republican, got 9.45%. Bull Moose Teddy got 8.86%. And Eugene Debs, the Socialist Party candidate, got 8.25%. Throw in a separate Socialist Labor candidate, and that put Debs and Roosevelt in a dead heat. Still, all totaled up, that's about 90% of Texans who voted for a progressive or a socialist in that election. That's the way things were across the West and South. They were still fighting the conservatives who ruled in places like New York. But within the Texas Democratic Party, there were two very distinct factions who would continue to do battle for the next 70 years, until the hardcore radical righties finally became Republicans. And that liberal faction continued to carry the ideas from the People's Party populist Pick a Peck of Pickled Peppers. Not only were some of these People's Party old-timers still left, that was the group that was nudging the Democrats into being liberals. That happened across the country, of course. Changed our national landscape a little under Wilson and those progressives, and a lot more during FDR and the New Deal. You think New York and East Coast elites with FDR, but a surprising number of the most liberal New Dealers, including the ones who were nudging Roosevelt farther left sometimes, were from the South, the West, and from Texas. FDR's first vice president was a Texan, John Nance Garner, but he was no liberal at heart, in spite of him being the guy who said the vice presidency, quote, wasn't worth a bucket of warm piss, end quote. He was more active than previous VPs, and he was vital in getting the New Deal legislation through Congress, where he had served for a long time. Still, Garner grumbled about labor strikes, powerful government, and deficit spending, so he is not the purveyor of populist ideas. I'm talking about guys like Wright Patman, who was just covered with populism like chocolate syrup at a kid's party. Patman was a World War I veteran who served in Congress for 24 straight terms, from 1929 till 1976 when he died. He sponsored a bill in 1935 to set minimum consumer prices so big national chain stores couldn't run little mom and pops out of business. We sure as shit could use that now to stop the Walmartinizing of the world. Patman had fought against the Klan at the start of his career, and he stood up for the Bonus Expeditionary Force in 1932, when thousands of his fellow World War I vets marched into Washington during the worst of the Depression, trying to get a military service bonus that had been deferred until after most of them would be dead. They were just trying to feed their families, like those old Alliance farmers, and Patman was their biggest advocate in Congress. But instead, Herbert Hoover, Douglas MacArthur, and Secretary of War Patrick Hurley set fire to their homeless camps, stabbed them with bayonets, shot at them with live ammo, and used the same kind of gas canisters the Army had used in France in 1918. Wright Patman, from the conservative 1st District in Northeast Texas, was an old People's Party populist who created both the Small Business Administration and federal credit unions. More than anything else, Patman fought against big banks and their consolidated power to do anything the hell they wanted. He saw them as the arrogant lunch money stealing bullies that they are. Finally, in his last years, Patman was the first guy in Congress to try to go after Nixon over the Watergate burglary by following the money from campaign contributions all the way to the Watergate plumber's back pockets. He got shut down, but winning isn't always everything. There's one last populist from back there in the 1890s who I should have mentioned. Sorry about that. His name was Sam Ely Johnson, Sr. He was a hugely successful rancher in the Texas Hill Country who lost all his land and money due to the vagaries of Texas weather and some bad personal business decisions. After being forced to live off his father-in-law for a decade, Sam worked his way back to another ranch, and he did so as a passionate leader of the Farmers Alliance and the People's Party. Sam Ely Johnson ran for the state legislature in 1894, and his conservative Democratic opponent was his son-in-law. Even though they were opponents, they'd make joint campaign appearances, and at one of them, Sam was facing a friendly populist crowd that got so pissed off at Clarence Martin, the son-in-law, that they booed him off the stage and then stabbed him in the stomach. Sam suspended his campaign while Martin healed up at home, and Sam lost the election, the only one he ever ran in. But Sam Johnson's grandson, the kid who inherited the ranch house and lapped up every lesson his old granddad offered, became the most liberal president we have ever had in our great nation's history. That liberal is a Texan through and fucking through, and that is Lyndon Baines Johnson. I will argue that case all day, every day. LBJ's Great Society, the most liberal legislative package in American history, came directly from his grandfather's Farmers Alliance and People's Party platforms. Health care for old people, early education available for people who can't afford it otherwise, a positive sea change on U.S. immigration policy that made us a stronger country, real and lasting civil rights laws, and the biggest concerted war on poverty that the United States had ever undertaken. All the leftover asks from the Farmers Alliance and the People's Party that had not become law under Wilson, FDR, or Truman became law under Lyndon Johnson, and a little more besides. There are plenty of other Texas liberals I'd love to toss out there for your listening enjoyment, but I don't have the time unless I want to make this a six-hour episode. Ann Richards was a darling who famously said that George W. Bush was born with a silver foot in his mouth. Barbara Jordan was a media sensation who was really more of a compromiser in legislating, and that's vital to getting things done. But Curtis Graves, who got elected to the Texas House in 1966, the same year Jordan went to the state Senate, was the real liberal of that bunch. There are two names I want to drop, though, because they tend to get forgotten these days by all the stereotyping East and West Coast whippersnappers. At the risk of sounding all nostalgic, like someone who needs to be put in a home post-haste, "Don't you little turd droppers," to quote my old pal Denny Johnston, "get all uppity, or I'll see to it that nobody gives you a cookie or wipes your chin." Stay off my lawn. The first is Sissy Farenthold. She came from a long line of very successful Texas lawyers and judges. She graduated from Vassar the year before Jackie Kennedy showed up. When Sissy was in the Texas House, she and Barbara Jordan co-sponsored the Equal Legal Rights Amendment of the Texas Constitution. She fought against nukes and for human rights. She was the first ever chair of the National Women's Political Caucus. It wasn't all white wine and four roses, though. She lost the governor's race twice in the Democratic primaries. And she had an apparently brain-damaged step-grandson who joined the Tea Party and got kicked out of Congress for wearing a bathrobe while naked, fat, ugly, and stupid. At least they weren't blood relatives, right? Sissy Farenthold, though, in 1972, was the first woman who was seriously nominated for vice president by a major party. There had been two other women earlier, but they were done mostly as a novelty and a courtesy. Sissy, though, got 404 votes on the convention floor and came in second place, beating sitting senators and an anonymous governor named Jimmy Carter. The guy who beat her was Tom Eagleton, who later had to resign from the ticket over hiding several hospitalizations for depression. So the Democrats should have gone with Sissy. Then she could have been the one only winning a single state, but later pointing at Nixon and screaming, "I told you so, assholes," at the American public. The other Texas lib I submit for your consideration is Ralph Yarborough. Back when JFK came on his little Texas tour in November 1963, he was accompanied around the state by the greatest Texas liberal of them all, Vice President Johnson, plus the governor of Texas, John Connally, who was part of the conservative Democrats. Of course, you know that Connally got the shit seat in the open limo and took a bullet, after which he had a religious conversion, assuming he had been spared by Lord Jesus send more money. Connally had been a good friend of LBJ, who helped him get the gig as governor, only to have Connally turn on him and the Great Society programs, and worst of all, push to make Texas a right-to-work-for-less state. But I was talking about Ralph Yarborough, and he was in the motorcade, too. Ralph could be a petulant little bastard, even though he was an important United States senator from the great state of Texas, trademarked official motto. Ralph felt that he was not getting enough attention. Plus, he was in the midst of a feud with Governor Connally, and he was pissed off at LBJ because Linda never thought twice about steamrolling over people. So when Yarborough was assigned to ride in the same convertible limo with the vice president, he threw a little girl hissy fit until Kennedy, who happened to be the president of the United States at the moment, took him aside, slapped him across the face, and said, "You can act like a man. Is this how you turn out? A Hollywood Pinocchio who cries like a woman? Bah, what can I do?" So Yarborough rode in the car with Lady Bird sitting between him and LBJ. But when Johnson became president, Ralph Yarborough was the only senator from a former Confederate state who voted for every single provision of LBJ's Great Society program. Every education program, civil rights program, environmental program, anti-poverty program, all of it. He was a co-sponsor of Head Start, the Bilingual Education Act, the Higher Education Act, an author of the Voting Rights Bill. Not unlike lots of liberals of his age, his views on race took a beat or two to fall into the right position, but they came. In the next election after Yarborough voted for the 1964 Civil Rights Bill, his Republican opponent was George H.W. Bush, and Bush called Yarborough a left-winger for supporting equal rights. Never forget that about Bush, will you? In spite of Yarborough's massive ego and a toupee in later life that Albert Brooks would have called more of a silver yachting cap, Ralph Yarborough was a great liberal in the U.S. Senate in the midst of the Civil Rights era. He once had a physical fight, a wrestling match, in the Senate cloakroom with Strom Thurmond when the two of them were 61 years old. Strom outweighed Ralph by 30 pounds and got Yarborough in a headlock. Damn, I am sorry there were no cell phones in 1964. Yarborough was energetic and evangelical giving speeches, in a style that built to a crescendo, with people jumping to their feet. It was a style people there at the time called populist. He co-sponsored the bill that created Medicare. He was an absolute pioneer when he co-authored the Endangered Species Act and set up federal preserves at Padre Island Seashore, the Guadalupe Mountains, and the Big Thicket of East Texas. And Ralph Yarborough, from little old Texas, was one of the very first senators to oppose the Vietnam War. And now Texas liberals seemingly crawl through the desert like it was a cartoon in The New Yorker. And whose fault is that? It's the Democrats, specifically the National Democratic Committee. If they would put in a meaningful spend for party building and get out the vote in Texas, the entire national landscape could be changed forever. The facts are simple. Texas has the second largest number of electoral votes and the second most members of Congress, so changing things in Texas would change the entire country. Right now, the Republicans have gerrymandered cities to the point that rural Texas has as much overinflated power as Wyoming does over California. Liberal voters feel as helpless as Screech trying to resist a room full of naked Bollywood actresses. The Texas population is 84% urban. Four of the 11 largest cities in the U.S. are in Texas: Houston, San Antonio, Dallas, and Austin, and all of them are run by Democrats. Houston hasn't had a Republican mayor in 42 years, and that's something that neither New York City or Los Angeles can claim. But in reality, it's super easy to change, if Texans would just freaking vote! You can't gerrymander the governor, lieutenant governor, and attorney general. There are millions of liberals in Texas. Only three states had more people cast votes for Hillary Clinton than Texas did in 2016. Same is true for Obama both times. If the National Democratic Party pulled their collective heads out of their evidently shared ass and wrote some checks, those turnout numbers would change, and no one would ever have to worry about radical right-wingers again unless they were hosting a spelling bee or left their livestock unattended. But people in Texas don't vote. They're discouraged, and hearing some holier-than-thou jack-off from Connecticut or Oregon lump all Texans together is not helping anybody. That ass-nozzle Abbott got reelected governor last time with the support of about 18% of voting-age Texans. 18%. So when I hear national pundits, people earning a shit ton more money than I do, say Texas voters this or deep red Texas, it just makes me want to eat a big rare steak, drink two shots of Reposado, climb into my gas-guzzling pickup, toss a couple of extra ammo magazines in the back seat, and go have a personal chat. Ha! I'm just kidding. I drive a Japanese SUV, and my favorite gun dispenses caulk. But that doesn't change the fact that most Texans do not vote. Let's face it, Americans in general are horrible at elections and should be embarrassed in front of the world, like they just did the yesterday's dress perp walk out of their auto mechanic's trailer. Only Tennessee and West Virginia, though, do worse at getting off their fat asses and going to the polls than Texas does. And only part of that is because the state legislature keeps making it harder to participate in our own democracy. That great Texas liberal Molly Ivins called Texas a laboratory for bad government, and for the last 30 years, that has been very true. Molly Ivins also said that all of American history has been one long struggle to extend the liberties established in our Constitution to every American, and that is also pretty spot on. She also called the Washington Press Corps a pack of sycophantic shih tzus wriggling on their bellies to kiss the feet of those in power. So clearly, Molly was another Texas populist who knew her stuff. I've got to agree with her when she said, "There's a world out there that needs fixing, so get out there and get after it." And it starts with knowing your own history. And yeah, I'm looking at you, Texas. Thanks for listening. Be sure to check out my website at mikevancewriter.com. Prick the Balloon is copyrighted by Mike Vance, all rights reserved.